Estate of Tamoulis v. Commissioner of Internal Revenue. Mr. Graham.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen of the court. My name is Hugh Graham. I represent here the estate of Father Tamoulis. Nathan Wetzel helps me more than we probably should have to. We have a simple proposition. I break it out into two areas. One of the thoughts is, as a matter of fact, if you look to our federal estate tax return as filed, we're trying to say something there. We're trying to say that, in fact, we're changing or transforming or taking away from the old documents which the decedent filed and making them into a charitable remainder unit trust. That's what we're saying.
You know, Mr. Graham?
Yes.
Oh, my. I really have a lot of sympathy with your position here. I want to make that very clear. But what I am having a very difficult time understanding is how a tax return can enact a change in a trust instrument itself.
I don't catch it. Could you please repeat it?
Well, you see, I guess you argued that with the filing of the tax return, the executor reformed the trust instrument to constitute a valid charitable remainder unit trust. But how would that tax return be binding under law on the trustee in making distributions from the trust? In other words, how can a...
All right, yes. Yeah. Yes, yeah. The point I would make in that regard is if you look to Schedule O itself, therein the trustee says, I have and hold and operate. He's acknowledging that this is the way in which he's going to operate this trust. So he's taken upon himself to say that's exactly how this is going to be functioning. So to my mind, and I did it largely because I've done a number of the charitable remainder unit trusts over time. And the Rev Proc itself, for example, that I allude to in the brief, the Rev Proc has as a notion in there.
But there, why not change what Judge Rovner is asking? If you want to curtail the trustee's discretion, then why not amend the trust instrument?
The reason I didn't do it right off the bat is that I felt that the trustee alone had the power because of the Rev Proc language. Secondly, the way that the beneficiaries in this trust, the trust is styled to run on the term of the life of A, a woman, the life of B, her husband, or 10 years. It was not just a 10-year certain or the joint life. I did not have any books that would let me know how to figure out what the actuarial value was of two joint lives together with the term of 10 years. So I decided because the term of time was less than 10 years, making it 10 years, it would be fair to the charities because arguably it would be a little bit longer than that if you used two joint lives together with 10 years.
I understand. Why, you say you didn't have the books to figure out what the actuarial value of this...
I didn't have the books to figure out the actuarial...
You hire someone to do that.
But what I'm saying is the revenue code itself says if you don't have it, they will figure it out. But I made the judgment to use 10 years because it was less than the probability of the two joint lives together with 10 years. Thus, it's going to enlarge the gift to charity, not reduce it, if I use a shorter 10-year term.
Why don't you just follow the law?
Well, I suppose I might have been... I wish maybe I'd done a lot of things differently. But we did it, as I say, mainly because to put the Revenue Service on notice that we're willing to be bound by their terms and conditions. I later on got the amendment signed by all the beneficiaries but for the one in Lithuania. I got the beneficiaries to sign mainly because I told the service on several occasions, I will get you this document, and I don't care whether we use this document, which had two lives plus 10 years, or I'll get you one that has just joint lives, either one, whatever you want. I'll have either beneficiary sign it. Finally, I decide I'm not going to just deal with my representations. I'm going to get a document. So that's why you have, I think it's Exhibit 17, that's why you actually have the trust agreement as signed by all the others. To answer your further question, though, I'm bothered by this. I have a deep suspicion of the belief that the beneficiaries have a right to change a document of this character. My basic thought is that when an interest takes its fixed character for income tax purposes, people can't thereafter tamper with it. I felt that the trustee is independent of that. I felt that the trustee has a duty to act as a fiduciary. That is one of the main reasons that I had just the trustee do it, coupled with this RevProc language that's the cookbook. It says, for there is a limited power of amendment, and it's restricted to the trustee, him acting alone and solely for the purpose of making these amendments to conform to the charitable remainder unit trust principles. These are some of the reasons why I put the service on notice exactly as what we're doing. Immediately upon the filing of the return, knowing that the thing was going to come up for audit, and if they had changes or suggestions using a different term of time, I could do it.
But
that's
wait,
why.
I missed something. Say that the trustee could amend the instrument by himself, so why didn't he do it?
I'm sorry?
You say the trustee could amend the instrument.
I thought he was doing it. I intended... By the language of Section O of the return, I intend to have it understood not that this was an intention on the part of the trustee, but actually that it was his action now. I use the word he holds and operates. It's in the present. That's why I did it.
Well, why didn't he just amend the trust to provide that?
I thought I was doing it that way by the language in the return.
Okay, well, thank you.
Right or wrong, but unfortunately, I suppose. But that's, I think the sense of it all is that what the service is trying to do is make sure by the language in the statute that there's notice on the part of the taxpayer that they intend to be bound by this act, and that come before 90 days have run. That's the purpose of the act, to have the notice come from the taxpayer, not from the service. We have more than met that. That's the message.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Dudek?
Thank you.
His glasses. Mr. Dudek, could you hand Mr. Graham his glasses, please? Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm John Dudek. I represent the commissioner. Let me reshuffle my papers here.
While you're shuffling, could I ask you a quick question? Because you argued that the tax return statement doesn't contain the words amend or reform, and so it's insufficient, right so far?
Okay. Correct.
Is it your position that if those words were used, there are circumstances in which a tax return could thereby change the trust instrument to constitute a charitable remainder unit trust?
No, Your Honor, that's not our position. Our position here is under the statutory scheme, you have to, where you're making a bequest that involves a charity or a religious organization, the payouts to the individual beneficiaries have to have specified fixed dollar amounts or percentage amounts. And if you don't have that, the deduction is denied. But there's a reformation procedure. And there are two reformation procedures, one for major defects, one for minor defects. So our position here is the only one they could use, only reformation procedure they could use was for the major defects, and that says that you have to bring a judicial proceeding within 90 days of the filing of the estate tax return. So in our view, that's the end of the case right there. The estate stipulated they did not bring a judicial proceeding within 90 days. So the case is over right there. They make the argument that this statement on the estate tax return should be treated as if it's a judicial proceeding, or should be treated as if it amended the trust instrument. And so the comment...
That would be within 90 days.
That they did that within 90 days. So our argument, well, on the face of it, our argument that it doesn't use the word amend, that goes to the point it's not really purporting to amend the trust instrument. And indeed...
But if it were, if we accepted his argument, then you wouldn't have a 90-day problem.
If you accept the argument that a statement on a tax return is sufficient to be a judicial proceeding... I mean, you would have to
a judicial proceeding, or
in other words, the only,
because you can only amend a trust with a judicial proceeding of some sort.
And that's correct. In other words, because he had made under the statutory scheme, because he had major defects in the payout rules, the only option Congress gave in a state in this situation was to move within 90 days of filing the estate tax return by bringing a judicial proceeding.
When you say a judicial proceeding, if a person wants to amend a trust, what do you do? You have to have a proceeding? I don't understand.
Under Illinois, there is an Illinois statute that says all the beneficiaries have to consent, agree to the change. But in addition, under this federal scheme, there would have to be a judicial court proceeding brought within the 90 days.
What would be the nature of the judicial proceeding? I don't understand.
To amend the trust to comply with the payout provisions in the Internal Revenue Code. All of the provisions in this trust did not have fixed dollar amounts, for example.
I don't understand, suppose normally, forgetting the tax thing, you want to amend a trust, so the trustee can't just amend it on his own. He has to get the... I mean, suppose they're adult beneficiaries, so you don't have problems. So all the beneficiaries are adults.
Okay.
Can't the trustee, if he gets their written consent, can't he just amend the trust? Or does there have to be some approval by a judge?
We're saying in this situation have to be...
Under general, trust law.
But the Illinois statute talks about having the consent of all beneficiaries.
Yes, I understand.
But beyond that, I just don't know what Illinois law would involve.
Of course, here...
It's odd, though, for federal tax law to require someone to institute a judicial proceeding. I mean, what if the Illinois court said, well, you don't need a judicial proceeding. If you have adult beneficiaries who want to change, and the trustee all want it, and then maybe the set lawyer, if you want, they all want to change. I mean, yeah, I wouldn't be here, but they all want to change it, and they can do that. There's no judicial proceeding.
But I think federal law would take precedent. Federal law, to the extent it relates to a tax deduction, would have to be in the mix if the estate wants its federal charitable contribution deduction.
Is treated literally.
Congress, when you review the legislative
cases on this, or
well, the main case that we rely on the brief is the Hall case, the state of Hall. It's a tax court in a Sixth Circuit case, and they strictly construed these statutory provisions there. The estate filed a form in the probate court within the 90-day period, and they argued that they later, after the 90 days ran, they brought the proceedings to amend the trust, and the Sixth Circuit said, well, that's the Sixth Circuit and the tax court both said, that's not enough. You have to construe this strictly. Congress was concerned this was an abusive situation dealing with gifts to charities. Congress was very concerned about fixing the problem in 1969. You know, the statute's been on the books for 30 years. So to cure the problem, they put these stringent rules in the Internal Revenue Code.
Well, what if an Illinois court said, well, actually, we just don't have a procedure for that. You know, if all the beneficiaries and the trustee agree on a change, you just do it. We don't.
There is an Illinois
jurisdiction for that, right?
There is an Illinois statute that contemplates proceedings brought under that relate to Section 2055 of the Internal Revenue Code.
So you're saying Illinois does have such a
procedure? It does have a proceeding.
So, Mr. Dudek, under 2055, you go to a district court and serve the notice upon the service. Is that right? Is that how you would?
I'm not schooled in that aspect of this case. I have no.
Well, I mean,
it's undisputed here that they didn't do anything.
No, I'm not sure if it was to Judge Posner whether you were talking about charitable versus non-charitable. We got a charitable situation here, so I guess that's the policy that drove this statute, right?
It comes out of the.
So your response to Judge Posner may or may not, you know, what the state does if it's not a charitable situation. I don't know what the answer is. Obviously, you don't either. But I'm just asking, in this case, what Mr. Graham should have done under your view is the judicial proceeding is to occur in a federal district court, right?
I guess he could have tried that. If he picked the wrong court, then presumably he would still be okay under the statutory scheme.
Representing the service. But you ought to tell us where we should go.
Well, Illinois does have the statute that contemplates an action. So
I think you're assuming Judge Flom is assuming that to modify a charitable trust,
that's what I'm
you need some kind of judicial procedure.
Otherwise, it'd
be too tempting to cut out the charity. So you go to state court, is that the idea?
Well, I know there is this Illinois statute. If you went to federal court and the federal judge said you're in the wrong court, presumably you would have told the statute this 90-day provision.
Right.
If you went to the wrong court, what
if one of our three states of our circuit doesn't have a provision? Then you go to the United States District Court and serve the notice on the service of this change?
I mean, that sounds reasonable to me, but I just don't know.
Well, it isn't your position.
But I know what Congress said in the statute.
Isn't the government's position that there was a failure to do that here?
That there's a stipulation in this case that there was no judicial proceeding brought in this case. There was a complaint drawn up. It was never filed. And so the most the estate did within the 90-day period was to attach this statement to its estate tax return.
All right, let's
under state hall, that's just not enough.
We're going nowhere, Mr. Dudek, on right. What court to go to. But you served the notice on the service. Is that the way this should be?
If it's appropriate. I mean, if this is a fight between the beneficiaries, if it's just a question of tidying up the trust.
How does the service know whether it's notified?
Well, right. Once it's notified, it can decide whether or not it wants to participate in the litigation.
That's served, I guess. I guess that's my question. I'm just trying to follow up on what's the appropriate procedure here. Under 2055, if there's an attempted change on a charitable trust.
Well, the statute says that it refers to a judicial proceeding is commenced to change the interest into a qualified interest not later than the 90th day after the filing of the tax return. That's the statutory language. And it was put in there. I mean, in this case, the estate took over a year to prepare its tax return, so it had plenty of time. And then in addition to that,
the puzzle is you make this federal tax benefit dependent apparently on filing some kind of state court proceeding.
Correct.
And then the question is, well, if the state court didn't recognize that, didn't have a proceeding, federal courts can't force state courts to entertain particular cases.
Your Honor, Illinois does have a procedure that's geared to the federal.
I'm just curious, if it didn't, what would a taxpayer do?
And I'm curious to know if it befuddled everything even more because you have a beneficiary in Lithuania with a medical school education that would not have a particular amount that might be known.
Well, that's our alternative argument, Your Honor, that there was some of the requests here. The amount is not ascertainable.
Right.
So in the event if you disagree with the tax court, then we ask that you remand back for consideration of that alternative argument.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dudek. Mr. Graham, how much time does he have? 2 minutes? 3 minutes? Do you have anything further?
Yes, I would like to. Should I go there?
Well, you can stay there if you're more comfortable. We can hear you.
A thought or two. The purpose of the statute is to afford notice to the Internal Revenue Service. More importantly, is to show that the taxpayer is committed to and agreed to the concept that he's bound by the Chevron Remainder Unit Trust rules. That's the purpose of the Act. The purpose of the Act is to show the service doesn't have the duty to police and tell the taxpayer 6 months into the audit, hey, bud, why don't you use this Chevron Remainder Unit Trust so you'll have a greater deduction? Is to relieve them from that burden. It's been known from the outset here exactly what this taxpayer intended. Let me deal with another issue since Judge Roper points out. This medical student in Lithuania. All of these shares are fixed in that federal tax return that's filed. There is no ambiguity as to how the interests are to be determined. You take the charitable deduction, you take the 5%. 5% is given to all the non-charity takers. It may be that one non-charity taker has a share that's greater or less than, depending upon where that kid is graduating. But the fact of the matter is the amount going to charity is going to remain constant. That's all spelled out in the tax return. The mechanics of every bit of these things are all spelled out clearly in the tax return. Let me address the other issue of the... The service, maybe wise there, no, they said make rules and regulations on this. There are none. There have not been any. Next, if you take the Illinois statute, it is said that all beneficiaries must sign. If you look to that chapter, that's the section. That's in the Charity Transformation Act under Illinois law. If you look to that act was created in 1971. In its first history, before its amendment that now takes care of our interests, in its first history, the trustee acting alone has the right to make changes. And I believe there, the trustee acting alone has the right, by state of Illinois law, acting alone, I believe it was just allowed to conform to these rules where you have the trustee take advantage of borrow, ability to borrow law or a private foundation. It was later amended in 75 to say that now, where you have the chairman remainder unit trust as we have here, then you need all adult beneficiaries as well. The only one that excludes is the interest of one who has expired, whose interest has already lapsed or run. Those are, I leave you with those notions. I think the centerpiece in it all is that intent on the part of the taxpayer is unequivocally spelled out in the return. The service is not prejudiced or harmed in any manner because of what has occurred. They said they're lien rights no matter what because they haven't started because they haven't given notice of the conclusion of it. I propose that that minor beneficiary in Lithuania, her interest we have not tampered with, we haven't reduced. Because her share was not changed and because she was not a remainder interest, there is no need to give her notice.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Graham.